From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at wnyc.org. WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. The article first appeared in Time magazine in March of this year, and it broke the story of an incident in November of 2005. Allegations that Marines in the Sunni stronghold of Haditha, Iraq, murdered Iraqi civilians to avenge the death of one of their own in an IED explosion. The original article placed the number of civilian deaths at 15, a figure that has since been upped to 24. The article spurred two military investigations. One will determine what happened and whether the incident was covered up, and the second will weigh whether criminal charges should be brought. For the military and the U.S. government, Haditha is still an open case. But for the press, it wasn't too soon to compare it to an earlier atrocity. Here's Fox News Channel's John Gibson.
My Lai, the name of the place in South Vietnam where a massacre occurred, a massacre carried out by American troops. For many people, the entire war in Vietnam came down to those two words, My Lai, and one more, massacre. Same thing is about to happen in Iraq, and this time the name is Haditha.
The specter of My Lai has been raised many times this week, and it came up 3 years ago when we first spoke to then-Major Robert Bateman about the process of embedding journalists, then new. Bateman, who is a military historian, is now a lieutenant colonel in the Army, recently returned from a year in Iraq. He joins us now in his role as an historian and not as an official spokesperson. Bob, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
So what was the impact of My Lai in 1970, and what can we learn from that experience?
Today, we all look at My Lai as, okay, this is the horrible thing, and it was universally condemned. And definitely, it was universally condemned by everybody who was opposed to the war. But even as late as 1970, there was a significant percentage of the population which was not opposed to the war and saw the trumpeting, as they called it, of My Lai as something that was being done as a political stunt. And there was pro-Lieutenant Callie songs and movements and counter-protests, disturbing as that is in hindsight. My Lai polarized the United States. A lot of people took what was a massacre, a failure of the military, and turned it into a political litmus test.
Now, when we first spoke with you back in 2003 at the beginning of the Iraq War, this is what you told me.
There were only about 70 accredited reporters in all of South Vietnam. That was more than enough to change the course of American history and American public opinion. But it wasn't enough to stop things like My Lai.
So are you suggesting that embedding journalists with troops would somehow diminish the possibility for atrocities?
I think it can't be helped, but they would be greatly diminished.
3 years later, after Abu Ghraib and now Haditha, would you reconsider what you said then?
I would not reconsider it. I still think the embedding program was and is a large success. My only caveat would be that when we first talked, there were a whole lot more reporters, hundreds upon hundreds of reporters. But we're back to sort of the way it was in Vietnam, where you've got 70 or 100 or 150 reporters trying to cover the war.
Do you think that having reporters at Haditha might have changed things?
Yes. Let me illustrate it with an example from the Second World War, winter of 1944. The Germans launched a massive surprise attack that has become popularly known as the Battle of the Bulge. During that attack, a German column of SS troops committed a massacre of American prisoners near a small Belgian town called Malmedy. A couple of the men managed to escape, and several days later made it back to U.S. lines, and the word started spreading like wildfire. Not long after that, when U.S. troops went on the offensive all along the line, you would have expected the number of German prisoners taken to skyrocket. The numbers don't support that. I've had several veterans who've come into my class when I was teaching at West Point. When I said, well, what was your reaction when you heard about Malmedy? The veterans standing there, not batting an eye, said, oh, we just really didn't take prisoners after that. Well, we'd take prisoners, but they wouldn't make it back to battalion.
No reporters reported that.
No.
What would you like to see the media do in cases like Haditha?
We won't know for some time what happened at Haditha. But I think that the media has already provided an invaluable service. It appears that Haditha was not being investigated until Time magazine brought forward to officers at the Multinational Forces Iraq headquarters. And when they saw that report, they said, you know what, there's something here to be looked into. In other words, Time magazine and journalism provided exactly the service that it is always saying that it does, but which many people dispute. I think it's a classic case. This goes in the win column for American journalism as far as being a watchdog.
So as far as you're concerned, the more media, the better.
Yeah, that's my position. But then I tend to take a long-term view.
Well, let me throw one more question at you. Do you think the media lost us the Vietnam War?
No, we lost the Vietnam War. United States Army and the Marine Corps particularly, with help from the Navy and the Air Force.
But it is still widely believed in the military that it's the media that lost the war.
It is something that I continually fight against with, you know, my discussions with peers, with the things that I write in our professional journals. My profession is, and has been since at least Vietnam, afraid of yours.
Bob Bateman, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lieutenant Colonel Robert Bateman is in the U.S. Army, and he's author of No Gun Ri, A Military History of the Korean War Incident.
U.S. courts have long recognized that public employees are on occasion witness to official misconduct, and so the courts have long accorded whistleblowers special protection. In other words, you can't be fired, demoted, or otherwise penalized for exposing wrongdoing, except that a 5-4 decision this week by the Supreme Court complicates that assumption. The court decided that if your job is to expose wrongdoing, the First Amendment can't protect you from being punished for it. Chicago law professor Jeffrey Stone says that's exactly the situation that confronted Los Angeles County Deputy District Attorney Richard Ceballos.
Well, he was concerned about a search warrant that had been obtained and looked into the matter, decided that, in his judgment, the warrant had been obtained improperly, and reported this to his superior. The superior then held a meeting with the individuals who had obtained the warrant. They objected to Ceballos' evaluation, and according to Ceballos, he was later demoted and transferred as a consequence of his reporting what he believed to have been the wrongdoing of those who had obtained the search warrant.
Strictly speaking, this is not a whistleblower's case, is it? It's a First Amendment case that could affect whistleblowers and how they may be treated by their employers.
Precisely. Whistleblower laws are enacted by the government to encourage employees to report wrongdoing, and nothing in this decision affects the application of those laws. What the court said is that the First Amendment, of its own effect, doesn't protect a government employee who, in the performance of his official responsibilities, reports wrongdoing to his superiors. This sounds very strange, because the court made clear that its holding did not affect the First Amendment rights of public employees to call a press conference and disclose publicly the same wrongdoing that, in this case, they reported as they were supposed to their employer. And that just seems so counterintuitive. I mean, how can you fire somebody for doing exactly what his job is?
Suppose I work for the Department of Transportation, for example. And I see that one of my colleagues has rigged some specs for a big highway building job, and I want to report it to the inspector general. Well, I'm protected under whistleblower statutes, but if someone in the inspector general's office decides that I'm right and sends the complaint upstairs to alert his supervisors, that person is subject to dismissal for sort of just being a bearer of bad news.
Correct. That's a great example.
Well, how weird is that, Jeff?
Well, it is very weird. And that's exactly what people who have criticized the opinion have identified. When the employee is simply doing what he is paid to do by the government, then the court says he's not acting as a citizen. He's simply acting as a public employee doing his job. And for the doing of that job, he has no First Amendment rights. Tobias is being punished for doing his job. But that's not a First Amendment right, is what the court's saying. It's perverse, but it's not a First Amendment right.
So his job is to evaluate search warrants and whether the probable cause is actually there. He found that, in his opinion, the deputies had actually kind of trumped up the case for the search warrant. He so reported that to his supervisors, and he finds himself persona non grata in his own department. So the question is, if the finding by the court was really quite narrow, will it have a chilling effect on whistleblowers doing what whistleblowers do?
There's an uncertainty that's created by the opinion. So I have no doubt that anyone who's thinking about being a whistleblower today, whether he's thinking about reporting to the government itself or whether he's thinking about reporting to the public, is going to have second thoughts about doing that as a result of this opinion.
Then if I may ask, what will be the upshot of all of this?
What worries me about the opinion, frankly, is that within it, there are possible seeds having to do with the questions of whistleblowing in a much more fundamental sense, like the NSA surveillance. And even though that case does not involve at all a government employee reporting to a superior in the performance of his duties, the court here, the majority here, clearly does not take a very sympathetic view of the value of what whistleblowers do.
What have we learned about Justice Alito?
A sensible view of this case would have led, I believe, the court to have said that this is a situation for balancing, that you don't automatically pigeonhole an employee who is reporting wrongdoing in this context as someone who is doing his job and is not acting as a citizen and is not protected by the First Amendment. That strikes me as a very rigid and mechanical analysis. And it's not surprising to see it from Scalia and Thomas. It's a little surprising to see it from Kennedy, but I think it is revealing about Roberts and Alito. I mean, this is not an opinion that I think can be supported by common sense or by a concern for the larger values of the Constitution. I think that does show a lack of thoughtfulness on the part of the two new justices.
Okay, Jeffrey, thank you so much, as always.
My pleasure, anytime.
Jeffrey Stone is professor of constitutional law at the University of Chicago.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. A little over a year ago, we floated a theoretical chaos scenario. It goes like this. Mainstream media, especially network TV, lose so much audience they can no longer attract the advertising revenue they need to sustain their content, leading to still more audience defection, then more advertiser defection, and so on into the toilet. All before the online Brave New World is ready to take over. In this past year, plenty has happened to add to the chaos. TiVo and DVR usage is rising, with Forrester Research estimating that by 2008, one in four households will be DVRing their favorite shows and skipping past commercials. iTunes has started selling hit TV shows for $1.99, and now all the networks are offering free streaming content on their websites. More options for us and more jeopardy for the old model. I asked Jeff Jarvis, blogger at BuzzMachine.com, if we are indeed in the midst of chaos.
We absolutely are. I mean, you look at just the last few weeks, ABC enraged its own channels of distribution and said, to heck with it, guys, I can't protect you anymore. I got to put our shows on iTunes and on the Internet.
When the networks decide to distribute their shows over the Internet instead of over the air, where will the money come from for them to generate hit programs that anyone wants to see over the Internet or anywhere else?
What's the definition of hit, Bob? In the future, you know, small is the new big. Do the big networks need big hits still? Yes, they're still in a blockbuster economy. But there's going to be a whole huge part of media that doesn't need to be that big, that can be big enough to be successful. Doesn't mean there isn't a lot of money to be made with a big mega hit, but the risk is ever, ever higher. The big old networks, the big old newspapers, the big old media companies are all shrinking.
Okay, so is it just going to shrink? Is it going to be orderly, or, you know, is there going to be blood on the streets here, Jeff?
Oh, it's chaos, without doubt. But the problem in America is what I hear media executives here say is they've got to hold on to that old world. Whereas in Europe, I hear media executives say, we got to get past into the new world as quickly as we can. Alan Rusbridger, the editor of The Guardian, imagines a world without presses. Tom Gloser, the head of Reuters, talks about a world where his consumers are now his editors. The head of Gruner & Jahr says the role of the journalist in the future is to be a moderator. Those are all entirely new ways to look at that. But here in America, what I hear is, how do we save the newspaper, save the newsroom, save the network, save the old business models? Well, folks, they're gone. Get over it and move to the future ahead of your audience, because if you wait, you're going to be steamrolled.
Jeff Jarvis blogs at BuzzMachine.com. If you're looking for the pulse of the old network model, a good place to start would be the upfronts. Each year, the networks stage huge spectacles for advertisers to pitch their new fall lineups. Up until a few years ago, networks would sell up to 80% of their ad space for the whole season within a few days. This year, the networks could possibly match the $9 billion they pulled in last year, but the long trend of annual increases in upfront revenue is almost certain to be over. An intimidating coalition of Walmart, Microsoft, and others want to do away with the upfronts altogether in exchange for an auction-like system. And still other big sponsors have given the upfronts a pass. Scott Donatan is the editorial director of Advertising Age, my other employer. He says that networks have traditionally used fear tactics to get advertisers to buy time up front.
They only have so many 30-second spots available in each show. And the fear that they planted in advertisers was always that if you don't buy this up front, you might come in later and it won't be there. And then how are you going to advertise? How are you going to reach your target? Or I'm going to charge you a huge premium up to 50% more. It's been a ridiculous fear-based market in which the power rested not with the money where it should, not with the advertisers who are spending the money, but with the networks who control the inventory.
Now, considering how precipitously network audiences have dropped off, has that kind of panic buying subsided? Are the upfronts losing some of their steam?
It's been clear to anyone with a brain for the last 5 to 7 years that the upfront as a process was out of date, out of step with where the marketing mindset was. And finally, this year, more than in any year before, because of the explosion of digital media, advertisers have said, wait a minute, we've got the power here, we've got the budget, and this is a ridiculous way to do business, and we're just not going to do it that way anymore. So this year's upfront hasn't gotten underway in a way that we actually know where it's going to end up yet. But last year, spending was flat, and everybody believes that we've now hit a turning point.
In fact, several major advertisers are boycotting the whole process. Johnson & Johnson, Coca-Cola.
The fact that some advertisers are holding back this year, saying, I'm not going to participate in that anymore. The advertisers that have said that, like Johnson & Johnson, aren't big enough yet to change the market on their own, but it's a hugely important symbolic first step. And the minute you have an advertiser with a really significant budget, a General Motors or a Procter & Gamble, these are companies that spend $3 billion a year in advertising, the minute one of those companies says, we're going to sit it out as well, then immediately the power of the networks will be gone because they won't be able to put that fear in your head that the inventory will be gone because some of the biggest spenders won't be snatching up all of that inventory.
So is it too early to tell what actually is going to happen this year?
it will probably be a little more slow and drawn out and rational than it has been. Some years, the upfront has sort of happened in a frenzy of late-night phone calls and frenzied buying, and then it's just done. It's beginning to be a more drawn-out process already. That will definitely happen this year. Whether that ends up meaning that pricing in the end looks flat or is down slightly, I can't say yet. But there's no doubt that we've hit the turning point year, that it's not going to sort of turn around back from this into a more irrational marketplace again.
Let's just say that this is the year that the networks actually see a drop in the price that they can get per set of viewer eyeballs. Will that not mean that they have fewer dollars to invest in programming and shrinking margins and all of the other things that could be the beginning of the end of the whole ecosystem?
I don't think it's going to be to the level where they can no longer produce quality content, but they're going to have to pick their shots a little more carefully. So I think network television will become, and mass media will become more event-driven. It's already beginning to happen, but I think you'll see the Super Bowl and American Idol finales and those places where the networks will be able to gather mass audiences. But we are definitely going to see a move away from network television, and those budgets are going to decrease. And that's a reality that the networks have to deal with, regardless of whether they have an upfront process or not. Advertisers are beginning to shift their spending to more targeted media, to the internet. There will still be an upfront in terms of a point in time where they stop and showcase their wares. But the fall season itself and the introduction of the fall season is something that no longer exists to the same event level that it did 10 or 20 years ago. They're introducing new shows all year round. Reality shows are coming in and out of the schedule all year round. And that shift is permanent and real.
Scott, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob.
Scott Donatan is the editorial director of Ad Age. Estimates say advertisers will spend less than $300 million on the network's online offerings, not much compared to the $9 billion total, but the networks are paying attention. You can now stream an entire episode of Lost, or three other shows, on ABC's new website for free. The Today Show also can be watched on the web in a free streaming format. CBS President Les Moonves said of his network's new online offerings, "With this broadband channel, we've essentially bypassed cable." But it's not just cable that's being bypassed by the plethora of new streaming options. Local affiliates presumably lose a viewer every time a show is downloaded from iTunes or streamed for free. Terry Heaton is a media consultant and president of Donata Communications, which advises many affiliate stations. Terry, welcome to On the Media.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Bob.
I remember a few years back, the automobile manufacturers tried to experiment with selling their cars to consumers directly via the internet. And the dealerships went crazy because they'd been cut out of the distribution chain that they'd cultivated for, 100 years. Is that what's happening here?
Well, I think exactly that's what's happening here. My clients are all local broadcasters, and so I'm very familiar with this. And they don't say a lot publicly about it, but privately, they're terribly concerned. I think they view the disruption of the internet as a threat more than an opportunity.
Well, briefly describe for me how an affiliate operates and how it makes its money.
Affiliates, in addition to making advertising money, also received, in many cases, pretty substantial compensation from the networks just to carry the programs. Well, they are paying them no compensation now, and there are a lot of people who suspect that they're going to want money from the local affiliates just to carry their programming. You know, the longer we go into this straight-to-consumer, the more that becomes an issue. But the network news operations need local affiliates to provide content. So I think local news still has many, many, many decades of legs.
Affiliates make most of their money from the local news, but most of their airtime is network broadcasting. So am I crazy, or if the networks bypass the affiliates for their main product of entertainment programming, what is there left for the affiliates to air, and what happens to their ability to stay in business?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. What's left is anything they can produce themselves. It's just these are public companies. They're margined as just as slim as it could possibly be. They have cut expenses every conceivable way. It's not just the networks that are squeezing them. It's the bottom line. So there are companies who are considering buying back their stock, and I think you will see companies do that, because that would allow them to be much more flexible. Now, let's remember, too, that cable companies already are devising strategies to move network affiliates off of the channel numbers that they're currently on, channel 2 on channel 348, or channel 5 on channel 186. And this is going to mean a loss of millions of dollars invested in branding, to say nothing about all the loyalty that goes with that channel number disappearing overnight.
Let's just say that this transformation that is underway is going to be too much for some local affiliates to handle. If stations start falling away, all of a sudden the networks don't have an affiliate in every major market, doesn't that make the whole system crumble?
Well, I don't know. The only thing I can say for sure is that what we're going to have in 2010 is different than what we have today. You see, when I go to broadcasters and I sit in their boardrooms, the first thing I say to them is that revenue isn't your problem. Audience is your problem. Fix the problem. The disruption is the personal media revolution and the fact that anybody can be a TV station or a radio station or a newspaper now. You know, this is what's happening around us in all media right now. But there still is a demand for local entertainment, local information. And how are you going to do that? And so that's the challenge I pose to broadcasters is, let's pretend we're not a TV station. Let's restructure your company. Let's say instead of being WKRN-TV, you're Young Multimedia of Nashville. And below that, you have various properties, one of which is a television station. That's the only way that these type of people can get their mind around what they have to do.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, I really appreciate it. And again, it's a pleasure to be here, Bob.
Terry Heaton is president of Donata Communications in Nashville, Tennessee.
The Tube is still where you go for sitcoms, soaps, sports, and the evening news. But for amateur video or vintage bloopers, not to mention some copyrighted clips, at least until the copyright holder complains, YouTube is where you want to be. This video sharing site has an estimated 12.5 million monthly visitors, making it one of the top 30 sites on the web, an unquestionable, if still money-losing, breakout success. Michelle Quinn wrote about it this week for the San Jose Mercury News. Michelle, welcome to OTM.
Hi, Brooke.
First of all, what kind of generalizations can you make about the content? I mean, is this mostly America's funniest home video quality? Is it mostly pirated TV and film? Is it mostly ads or archival material? Has it become smutty or violent?
I think that you hit some of their main categories there. There's one video really popular last week of a poor kid named Edgar falling down. It had like a million views, and I thought it was completely appalling. People tell me all the time that they go on there to see old Simpsons shows or old South Park or something that they missed a week ago or 10 years ago. But if you spend some time there, you'll start to see video responses to video. So there are people creating little mini dramas about their lives. So here I am taking my Prozac, and then here I am, you know, petting my cat. In one case that I found amazing, there was a guy who'd wear a mask and would do magic tricks, and he had a huge following. And one of YouTube's competitors signed him away, just like a ball club. You know, here's a guy in his living room, and they took him away. He did a goodbye YouTube video, and now you can find him on another site called Revver.com.
Do you find that somewhat bewildering that, you know, people who say, now I'm taking my Prozac, now I'm petting my cat, now I'm brushing my teeth, can actually assemble an audience? I mean, there's something sort of Warholian about these kinds of films.
It's kind of intriguing, the simple things in life being highlighted for a day. Like, there's one woman who has a bite of ice cream and has a brain freeze, and so you get to see her face contort. I forgot how painful a brain freeze is. But here I got to see it and relive it again from this woman. It is a new art form in a way of people documenting their lives in ways that haven't been done before.
And people are posting, what, about 35,000 videos a day on YouTube?
Yep, I think the new number is more than 40,000 videos are being posted a day.
For a long time, there's been a lot of video on the internet. How does YouTube change the equation?
YouTube came up with three breakthroughs. One is they let you watch the video on Flash, which is a software program that easily compresses the video and then expands it when you want to watch it. So that made it easy for people to upload and watch a video.
These are people who used to have to deal with issues of compatibility and dueling media players and so on before then?
You've got it exactly right. Two other things, immediate playback. And the third thing was that you can take the video and put it on a web page. So these three things happened. But the other big thing that happened was that a lot of people in the U.S. have high-speed internet. And taking videos and watching video has really increased. So all these things happened roughly at the same time, and YouTube was there.
Microsoft had conducted a study that found, and maybe we should consider the source, but it found that 40% of U.S. cable TV subscribers are unhappy with their current service because it lacks variety of content and features. And as a result, more and more people are planning their evening viewing through their mouse rather than through their remote. Do you think that's why YouTube is doing so well?
Well, of course, we can't necessarily trust the Microsoft survey. It does seem right from what I know from people in my life. They complain about their cable service all the time. And I can see a day where you have a little searcher out there on the internet who will gather for you a nighttime of entertainment that might include four short videos that are funny, you know, some longer videos, and maybe a series that you like to watch. Maybe we're not too far off from it, where the TV and the PC really merge as the same thing. You know, it's funny, when I talk to people who are under 24, maybe they're in college, and they said, we don't even watch TV in college because everybody has a laptop. So I think that for a younger generation, they're going to demand it more.
But as broadcast television begins to offer more and more of its shows on demand via the internet, will YouTube be able to get a piece of that action?
As they tell me, they're talking to every studio, almost every music company. They are talking to major retail advertisers. They see a role for themselves, but I don't really know how it's going to work with companies like NBC, CBS. You know, they might decide to put a tease on YouTube and then drive the traffic back to NBC's website or CBS's website. So that's the kind of thing, my guess is what's going to happen. YouTube sort of created this extra public space where you watch short video that hadn't been there before. And if you're a smart content company, you want to be in that space, even if it is to try to bring people back to where you are.
All right. Michelle, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brooke.
Michelle Quinn is a reporter for the San Jose Mercury News.
Coming up, the lousy journalism that united a nation, ours.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the Kresge Foundation, investing in nonprofits to help them catalyze growth, connect to stakeholders, and challenge greater support. On the web at kresge.org. The Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities. On the web at wallacefoundation.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need. On the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. With the recent death of a CBS cameraman and sound man, Iraq has become the deadliest war for journalists. 77 killed, compared with 63 in Vietnam and 69 in World War II, according to the Freedom Forum. Sad as those casualties are, we've come to expect them as an occupational hazard.
but we're less accustomed to reporters dying on American soil, which may be why the death of Arizona Republic reporter Don Bowles still resonates. He was investigating organized crime when his car exploded in Phoenix 30 years ago this past Friday. Bowles' death was so notable that the Newseum, a journalism museum set to reopen next year in Washington, will devote an entire gallery to his life. But the following story, which first aired in 2004, isn't about heroism in the line of duty. It's about a unique collaboration of dozens of reporters from around the country who, drawn together by Bowles' murder, forgot that they were competitors and converged on his hometown to finish his work. It was called the Arizona Project. From Phoenix, Steve Goldstein recounts the tale.
When Don Bowles' car was blown up on June 2, 1976, the explosion was recorded by an attorney who was dictating in his nearby office.
Stage would be to, for me to file.
Bowles died in a Phoenix hospital 11 days later, following a series of operations to amputate one arm and both legs. Bowles had investigated organized crime for the Arizona Republic for more than a decade and made some enemies. The Republic staff tried to fill Bowles' void, turning their shock and anger toward work. Bob Early was a city editor at the Republic and Don Bowles' boss.
When we found out that it was one of our guys, we mobilized the whole effort of reporting it. So there wasn't a whole lot of time to be shocked or to think about it.
Meanwhile, in Indianapolis, at the inaugural convention of the Investigative Reporters and Editors Organization, an unprecedented decision was made. The IRE would send a team to Arizona to follow up on Bowles' investigations. Newsday's Bob Green led the team. He says the reporters weren't going to try to solve Bowles' murder. Instead, they wanted to investigate and illuminate the conditions that led to it. They would try to use journalism as a weapon.
Here was a society that felt, at least some elements of it, felt it was permissible to kill a reporter to stop his work. Now, the question in our mind was to go out there and examine that society, particularly in light of what he had been working on.
Bob Early was glad the reporters were coming to Phoenix.
Any kind of show of strength, it seemed to me, would be beneficial for us so that these kind of things wouldn't happen again. The more heat that we could bring on to the criminal element as a result of this, and also, you know, to government and the politicians, would have been very beneficial to us.
Over the course of 6 months, 38 journalists worked on the project. Many of them had never met Bowles. Members teamed up to investigate the influence of organized crime in the state, from prostitution to illegal immigration to land fraud. Six of the team members were involved from start to finish, but most could only commit to a couple of weeks. So Bob Green developed a system of cross-indexed files that would let newer reporters get up to speed quickly. The group's efforts drew attention in Arizona, and it also sparked high-profile interest from the CBS News magazine, 60 Minutes.
When they blew up an Arizona reporter named Don Bowles, they may have blown up a lot more than they bargained for.
It also got the attention of rival newspapers. The New York Times and the Washington Post said the project was misguided at best. Bob Green.
New York Times, Abe Rosenthal, who I had great respect for, said if this is to be done, it shouldn't be done collectively. The New York Times will do it. The Times didn't do it, so fortunately we did. Ben Bradley in the Washington Post opposed it. First statement he made was that investigative reporters cannot sit in the same room for more than 3 days without going at each other's throats. It'll never work.
But it did work. On March 13, 1977, newspapers across the country published the first of a 23-part series produced by the Arizona Project team. It chronicled alleged corruption in Arizona business and politics. But none of those stories appeared in Don Bowles' paper. Nina Pulliam, publisher of the Arizona Republic, made the decision. Former city editor Bob Early says the paper should have published the series.
What our publisher at the time was concerned about was the fact that we were going to publish things that were in some tone accusatory, and so they were concerned about legal action. I didn't have any concerns about that.
I was outraged.
Again, Bob Green.
Here was a newspaper that had been cooperating with us all the way along the line on the Bob Early level, which was the city editor level. and which all of a sudden now is saying they never had any part of the project.
Green wasn't alone in his anger. The general manager of local radio station KOY was stunned by the Republic's decision. So he decided the station should read the series on the air every night at 6:30 to keep Phoenix residents informed.
As a public service, KOY News now presents a comprehensive review of today's report by the Investigative Reporters and Editors Incorporated. Since today is
As a reporter for the Indianapolis Star, Myrta Pulliam was part of the Arizona Project. She was affected professionally and personally by the Republic's decision not to publish the series. The publisher was her grandmother.
You know, if somebody kills a reporter, this is the kind of attention that's going to get turned on you. People from all over the country are going to come out here, and you're going to be put under a microscope. And no criminal, no person in their right mind wants that to happen to them. I think that that worked. The fact that we were all there, that there was so much attention, really was an insurance policy and still is to this day.
The Arizona Project won a number of journalism awards and was nominated for a special Pulitzer Prize. Three men were convicted in the killing of Don Bowles. One died in 2002. Another was released from prison in 1998 and is free today. The third is still in jail, serving a life sentence in Arizona. For On the Media, I'm Steve Goldstein.
Those of us who live in modern-day America sometimes reflect with something like nostalgia on America's glorious beginning. You know, the days when great men roamed the fresh new streets of our great cities, thought great thoughts, and printed them in great newspapers? Well, actually, not so great newspapers, as Eric Burns proves persuasively in his new book called Infamous Scribblers, The Founding Fathers and the Rowdy Beginnings of American Journalism. Burns is also the host of Fox News Channel's Fox News Watch, and he joins us now. Welcome to the show.
I feel welcome, Brooke. I'm happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
So let's talk about America's first great newspaper-generated scandal. It featured a celebrity who the newspaper charged with acting recklessly. I'm talking, of course, about Cotton Mather.
Cotton Mather, who was a celebrity because he was the primary religious figure, not only in Boston, but in Massachusetts and in the colonies at the time. He was the son of Increase Mather, who was also a famous cleric and had been at one point the president of Harvard. And he was also, Cotton, the author of more than 400 books. On the other side, there was James Franklin, who I think we could probably call America's first crusading journalist. He founded a paper called the New England Courant. The problem, Brooke, was that he wasn't very good at picking his crusades. His first one, for instance, was against inoculation for smallpox. And because the Mathers and other notable figures in Massachusetts believed in it at the time, and because Franklin just had some kind of built-in, almost prenatal, it seems, grudge against the establishment, he savaged the Mathers and everyone else who believed in inoculation. And then, when it was proven that inoculation was the cure for smallpox, he did something very modern as a journalist. He dropped the subject. No retraction, no apology. He went on to his next crusade.
And his next crusade eventually got him kicked off his paper.
Well, the next crusade was actually more political in nature. He just thought that the political officials who were running Massachusetts, and they were appointed by the crown, were not doing nearly enough, for instance, to prevent the ravages of pirates along the Massachusetts shore. He didn't like the way a lot of the internal workings of the government went. And he criticized the government so much that he finally had to flee the colony. Back then, by the way, Brooke, you had to get permission from the government to start a newspaper. And James Franklin was in trouble right from the start because he never got that permission initially.
And so when he fled the colony, he left his print shop in the hands of his young apprentice, 9 years younger than he was, his younger brother, Benjamin Franklin.
Who he did not like at all. He probably beat Benjamin physically. We know that he would not let Ben write for the paper. As a matter of fact, Ben's first writings ever to appear in print were published under the name in the New England Courant of Silence Dugood, who purported to be a 60-year-old widow. Now, here's Ben, I don't know, 13, 14, 15 years old, male, writing letters as if he were a 60-year-old woman because he wanted to do anything he could to hide the real identity of the author from his brother. And he was right to do that. If his brother had known who Silence Dugood was, Ben would not have been published in the New England Courant.
Benjamin Franklin was quite fond of women's names as pseudonyms, wasn't he?
He was. He was not only Silence Dugood, but at another point he was Alice Addertongue. He was Celia Shortface. And in fact, everyone who wrote journalism in colonial times did so under another name.
You have a list of the names that Alexander Hamilton used.
Yes, he was Publius, he was Pacificus, he was Catullus, he was Americanus, he was Metellus, Horatius, just to name a few. Initially, people chose pseudonyms to hide their identity because it was just thought to be a little gauche to be expressing your opinions as crudely as so many of the founders did. To me, the most fascinating thing to consider about infamous scribblers is that the golden age of America's founding turned out to be the gutter age of American journalism. It took a long time for fairness to become an ideal in journalism. The greatest example of unfairness is Sam Adams. Now, as a brand of beer, Sam Adams, I guess, is one of the best.
And as a brand of patriot, one of the best.
Yes, because his horrible means were devoted to one of history's great ends. But consider just as a journalist, Brooke, he wrote lies. He wrote about British soldiers in Boston sexually assaulting American women on the streets of Boston. This is before the war, because he wanted to bring war about. You would not know from his writing, but the Boston Tea Party was as much the Boston Gazette's as it was the city of Boston's. It was probably planned in the Boston Gazette offices. A lot of the, what should we call them, marauders, we shouldn't call them Indians, but the marauders who made themselves up to be Indians, they did that at the Boston Gazette. And some historians think that afterwards, after they had dumped, I think it was something like 340 barrels of tea into Boston Harbor, after that had been done, some of them went back to the Boston Gazette to have a little drink in celebration.
We've been talking so far about patriot publishers, which were a scurrilous lot, I guess, in themselves oftentimes. But perhaps the most fascinating and certainly the most mysterious of the publishers that you cite isn't a patriot, but a determined Tory by the name of Jemmy Rivington, who spilled tons of ink excoriating George Washington.
It was very tough to be a printer in those days who sympathized with the crown because there was so much opposition. And people wondered how it was that he could get away with this. Now, he didn't get away with it as far as the populace was concerned. People hated his newspaper, but he was never arrested. No government officials ever came to visit him, except to browse occasionally through his bookstore in the back of his printing office. And the reason the government officials did that is that we later found out that Jemmy Rivington was a spy. And because he was so trusted by the crown, he would occasionally glean bits of military intelligence. He would write them down on sheets of paper, slip them into the pages of his books, and General Washington would occasionally send his men into Jemmy's bookstore to buy a book, and in that book would be information. We don't know the nature of it because it has not lasted the centuries, but it could have been information that saved American lives and perhaps sped up the course of the war.
How important do you think American newspapers were, in general, in determining the outcome of the war?
I think they were crucial. It is not just my view. It is the view of a lot of other historians. It is also the view of the British at the times. When the war ended, several British officers were known to say, if it had not been for your newspapers, for colonial newspapers, you would not have won the war. Newspapers were a source of unity to this nation before it was a nation, at a time when it needed unity as much as it needed ammunition.
And then after it was a nation, newspapers were a source, I think you could argue, of great disunity. In fact, later in Washington, after the Revolution, the argument began over what kind of a nation to create. Two newspapers lined up as proxies in the battle between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson, which is to say the war between the Federalists who supported a strong central government and the Republicans who supported giving more power to the states.
It's a remarkable and little-known story. Hamilton and Jefferson both served in Washington's cabinet, and it made sense for Hamilton to do so because he was a Federalist, like Washington. It didn't make sense for Jefferson to do so because he was the leading figure of the opposition, but he was a very famous and estimable man, so Washington appointed him Secretary of State. Hamilton was Secretary of the Treasury, and he appropriated Treasury Department funds to start a newspaper to promote Washington's point of view. One thinks today of George Bush paying money to Armstrong Williams to do something similar. But Hamilton defended this. He said, what better use for government money than to promote the government side of an issue, to let people know what the government thinks? All right, we'll give him a pass on that, sort of. But Jefferson appropriated, or misappropriated, I should say, State Department money to trash the very government in which he held one of the highest positions. And not only that, he helped to found the newspaper. He helped to choose the editor. And he would, Brooke, on occasion, leave the door of the State Department unlocked at night so that the editor, who was named Philip Freneau and was one of the most famous poets of the first century of American life, Freneau would come in at night, and Jefferson would leave drafts of documents on his desk that could be quoted out of context to make the administration look bad.
So the history of the leak, as old as the nation itself.
Older even than the example I just gave you. Most historians believe that George Washington invented the leak and did it the same way that it's done now. He would have some of his cabinet officers, some of his military officials take a journalist out, give him information, and say, now listen, you can print this, but you've got to say it this way. This is the truth, and P.S., print it as I tell you, and you'll get more. The problem was that leaks turned out to be like Frankenstein's monster. Once created, they could not be controlled. And therefore, a few years after Washington invented the leak, Jefferson, to use one example, was using the very same principle against him.
In telling that fascinating and little-known tale of the two newspapers, both of which were acting as the voices of the warring factions of the administration back at the beginning of the nation, did you get a sense of deja vu? Your employer, Fox News Channel, has often been tarred with the brush of being the voice of the Bush administration.
It has been charged with that, yes. No one has ever gone so far as to suggest that government money is being funneled to Fox, as government money was being funneled by Jefferson and Hamilton. So I was either wise enough not to get a sense of deja vu or wise enough not to admit it to you on the media. Take your pick.
Eric Burns is the host of Fox News Watch on the Fox News Channel and author of Infamous Scribblers, The Founding Fathers and Rowdy Beginnings of American Journalism. Eric, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Brooke. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director, and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We say a sad goodbye to our fabulous interns, Mark Phillips and Ani Katz. Thank you, guys. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer, and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by Ciaobella Gelato, purveyors of all natural gelato and sorbet. Ciaobella is available nationwide at specialty food markets. More information at ciaobellagelato.com or 1-800-GELATO-3. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org. And thanks.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.